think I would not be doing you justice if we didn't talk about those as well. And so you're going to see some other things on here, and yes, it is testable. I'm not saying that because it is not specifically outlined on your syllabus that it couldn't be testable, because it can be. If there's anything that I'm just telling you on the side, that's a felony before, I will tell you that. But everything else is testable, okay? The other question y'all always ask me is if I'm writing test questions, and I'm not. That's why Ms. Akins is in here, and she has watched the lecture, because she'll be the one writing the test questions, but she does let me see them. I could, she's just being kind, and I appreciate that. So, well, and they might be, because I left my test bank behind when I left. So, but I'm going to say they're all Ms. Akins, and that way they don't wipe it and send her, okay? All right, so we're going to talk about blue pumps. So if you look at this picture over here, this is the heart, or an elementary drawing of the heart. And you have your venous side and you have your arterial side. I want y'all to label on here so it will make good sense to you. Does anybody know this is your aortic arch? Y'all know that, right? And then you have these three vessels that are coming off the top. And once, I promise, you knew what these were, because you had to pass a test that they were on. But it's been a few minutes. So does anybody know what this line is? What this vessel is? Okay, so the middle one is your left carotid. So write that in. This one is your left subclavian. So it goes off, shoots off here, goes under the clavicle, and then goes down to supply your left arm. This is your carotid, goes straight up into the side of your neck, up into your head. Supply your brain. And this one, they cut it off so you can't see, but this one comes off and immediately splits into two and becomes the right carotid and the right subclavian. But this is called the brachiocephalic, which makes sense because it splits into two and supplies the brachio and the cephalic, right? So the left side gets two separate vessels. The right side gets one that splits into two. This is going to be important in a minute. And this is another example of me telling you, if you don't know your anatomy, it's going to make you real hard to understand. It's going to be real hard to understand hemodynamics, because it all builds on that, unfortunately. So that's why I start here. So this is your heart. This is your aorta. Squeezes blood out of the aorta, goes down to here. Down here, I want you to draw two little vessels coming off. This picture doesn't go down far enough, but you know, if you look at your aorta, you start seeing shoots up on deep, deep, deep like this. We're going to learn all those, but the top ones are your renal arteries. The reason why they're not on this picture is because they'd be too high, but I want you to draw them right here so that you know that that's where they live. The top ones that come off are your renals. I'm trying to drink my coat, put the lid on. I need more sleep. Okay. So a blood pump is a long catheter with a rim on the end of it, which sounds similar to a PA catheter, but it is very different, because instead of having a little round balloon like a PA catheter did, it has this big, long circus balloon that looks like we can make party animals out of it, right? So they will go usually through a groin. It doesn't have to be, but everyone I've ever seen has been that way. We'll go in through a groin into the artery, not into the vein. You remember, we put a PA catheter in, we went in like we were putting in a triple loaded. We wound up in an artery, but we got there through a vein. This is an arterial access, usually in the groin, that they come in through the artery, they thread up through the aorta, and this is home for this little fella. Just like the PA catheter had its perfect home, where when the balloon's up or wedged, the balloon's down, it's not. This is where this is supposed to live. And home for a balloon pump is supposed to be in the middle between this vessel and their renal arteries. And we don't want to block any vessels home. So that big dead space in the aorta is where we want this balloon pump to live. What the purpose of this balloon pump is, it's connected to a computer that's at the bedside that controls it. We're going to see some pictures of that in a minute. But it inflates and deflates with the cycle of the heart, so that when the heart is filling and the ventricle is relaxed and the aortic valve is closed, this balloon pops open and pushes all that rich oxygenated blood that's just sitting there in that dead space in the aorta and pushes it both directions. It pushes it this way, which perfuses what? My brain, my upper extremities. And it pushes it this way, which does what? Perfuses my kidneys and everything else. So that we get rid of all this blood that's already oxygenated and ready to go to work, that's doing nothing because it's just sitting there in shot. We need every bit of oxygenated blood that we have to push forward and perfuse something, because we are in crisis at that point. So that's half of what the balloon pump does, is during diastole, when the ventricles relax, it inflates to shove blood forward, to get rid of the dead space. But the minute that the ventricle starts to squeeze, and the aortic valve opens, the minute we open that door, the balloon goes, oh, and deflates, which almost creates a vacuum in the aorta. So it doesn't really, but it almost kind of pulls blood out of the ventricles into the aorta. Because if it deflates as soon as that door opens and almost creates a vacuum, what did we just do to our afterload? We decreased it. Afterload is the pressure or the force that the heart has to overcome to eject blood from the ventricle. And if I'm sucking you out the door, what did I do to my afterload? I greatly decreased it. So what did I do to my cardiac output? I increased it because I'm shoving blood. I'm helping. So my cardiac output is increased because I'm pushing blood forward, and because I'm sucking blood out of the ventricle, and cardiac output is heart rate times stroke volume, and I didn't affect the heart rate. I had nothing to do with heart rate, but what did I just do to my stroke volume?
Increased it.
What's stroke volume?
The amount of blood.
How much blood the heart ejects in one beat? What does a balloon pump do to stroke volume?
Increases
it a little bit. So what did I do to cardiac index? If I made cardiac output go up and I didn't cut off a leg, then what did I do to cardiac index? I increased it, because what is cardiac index? Is cardiac output related to your body surface area? And putting a balloon pump into you did not change your body surface area, right? So if I made cardiac output go up, then I made cardiac index go up, unless I changed how big you are. What did I do to SVR? Y'all are so smart, I love it. Decreased SVR, because SVR is the vascular resistance, and I am helping blood come out of the ventricle. What did I do to coronary perfusion?
Increased
it, because I'm shoving blood during diastole. Now keep in mind, Ms. Atkins taught y'all this a long time ago, so dig deep. But your coronary arteries get perfused during systole or diastole? During diastole, because the valve has to close and get out of the way for the anatomical position of where the coronary arteries feed off under the aorta to be able to perfuse. So although we perfuse mostly during systole, not the coronary arteries, they're during diastole. And so when this is closed, when the aortic valve is closed and that opening to the coronary arteries is not blocked, that's when the balloon inflates and shoves blood back into the coronary arteries, which increases their perfusion. But we do our renal perfusion. Increase. What's going to happen to your urine output? So what if you have a patient with a balloon pump and you notice that suddenly their urine output has dropped off? Look back at your picture. What you worried about?
Going down.
Is your balloon pump inflating like it's supposed to? It is. If it's not, it would be alarming like crazy. So it is. So what are you afraid might have happened? It got pulled out. Because the first thing, if it gets pulled back, the first thing it's going to block is your renal arteries. So we monitor urine output on these guys hourly. We watch it closely. And if your urine output has a sudden change and none of your other hemodynamic parameters have changed, you're looking to see, have I caused a blockage of the renal arteries because my balloon pump's been pulled back? What else do you think you might check every hour? What if it gets pushed too far in? What's the first thing it's going to block off? Brain is first? Look at your arteries. Look at your arteries. So how can I measure or assess if I have good perfusion through my subclavian vein artery? Checking pulses. So we're going to check radial pulses every hour. And we're going to compare left to right. Because what should happen if we catch it early is we're going to see a diminished pulse in our left arm. It doesn't match right. And we're going to go see how deep is my balloon pump. Am I blocking off that left subclavian artery? We're also going to check fetal pulses, not because of position of the catheter, but how did we get here? We got inserted through a femoral artery. And what does the femoral artery supply? Your legs. And so you're going to be checking fetal pulses bilaterally, because I want to make sure that the catheter is not so big that I'm blocking blood in my foot and I'm going to wind up losing a leg over this. Now, we'll tell you, we've had a patient that was so sick before that they had a balloon pump in place and they had a moderate cold foot and they chose to keep it in, because you can live without a foot. But you can't really live without hardware brain. So sometimes it's a risk benefit, but we do want to catch that early and intervene if we can to try to save the fluid if we can. So who do we put balloon pumps in? People who are in heart failure, cardiac shock, have had a BMI, unstable angina, intractable ventricular dysrhythmia, which means they had a ventricular dysrhythmia, we treated it, and we can't get it to stop. It is continuing despite treatment. Septic shock. When they do trauma, the trauma labs is one of the easiest ones y'all gonna love it because it's very black and white. You will be so happy. It's very black and white. If you're in a wreck and you hit a tree and you bang your chest against the steering wheel, where's your trauma going to be? In your chest. It's like that. That's how trauma is. So your heart laying into your chest, the left ventricle sits in the front. So when you bang your chest against your sternum, it's the left ventricle that gets the damage. And so those trauma patients that hit their steering wheel or have a seatbelt against them and it caused a contusion on their left ventricle, we have to put balloon pumps in them sometimes because that needs time to heal. And so we're trying to help the left ventricle have time to recover. Or we can be bridged into another device. It may be that the patient needs an LVAD, needs to go on ECMO, needs to have a heart transplant, and we're just giving them some support until we get to that point. Contraindications, we have some absolute and some relative. If they have aortic insufficiency, they cannot have a balloon pump. Anybody tell me why? First of all, what's aortic insufficiency? Where the aorta is insufficient. I've missed teaching nursing school. That is correct. It's actually the aortic valve, not the aorta. So aortic insufficiency means that the valve has a leak in it, which means that when the valve is closed, it's still letting blood come back through it. So it can be called aortic insufficiency or aortic regurge. Those are the same thing. It means when the door is closed, it leaks. Why would we not want to put a balloon pump in somebody who has a leaky aortic valve? It pushes blood right back into the left ventricle. So what have we just done to the patient? We have worsened their heart failure. It is better for them to be without it than to have a balloon pump. Because the door that's supposed to close to allow the left ventricle to fill won't close all the way. So when I inflate during the diastole, I'm shoving blood back into the left ventricle, and we're just moving oxygenated blood back and forth between the aorta and the ventricle, and that's bad. That didn't help anybody. If they have a dissecting aortic aneurysm, it makes good sense that we shouldn't have a balloon that's banging against the wall of their aorta 60 to 100 times a minute if it's dissecting, right? If they have end-stage cardiomyopathy, the reason why it's relative is because we have to have a plan. I mean, end-stage cardiomyopathy is a reason why we put in an LVAD, is a reason why we do a heart transplant. So if we are bridging to a therapy or we think that they're going to be able to recover some function, well, then they might get a balloon pump. But if there is no end game, then there's no reason to put a balloon pump in because we're never going to get them off of it. If they have severe atherosclerosis, you're worried about two things. You're worried about they're having so much plaque at the insertion site that you're going to lose a leg over it, or that there's so much plaque inside the aorta with it beating 60 to 100 times a minute that we're just going to shower plaque downstream and block everything below that, and that's not good. Relative, that was, you never do it because they're never in the mall. You're cracking me up. That's why it's relative, and what that says to you is gray. Beside relative, right gray. It's not black and white. You can do it for end-stage cardiomyopathy if you're bridging to a goal. If you think you're going to recover some function, or you have some device we're trying to get to. No. People are not walking around Walmart with these. You have to be in ICU, in a bed. Yeah, this is not permanent. And when I show you one in a minute, and that's a good question, because we have people walking around with LVADs, and if I showed you the cartoon of an LVAD, it looks very similar, so that's a very good question. But this is actually, no, it is, you're in ICU, being monitored by critical care nurses, it's not something. Temporary crisis intervention to either allow you time to heal or bridge you to another device. And if they have end-stage cardiomyopathy and we're bridging to another device, then more power to you, we can do that. But if they're not a candidate for a heart transplant, an LVAD, any of that, well, then why are we going to put a balloon pump in them if there's no end game? Like, what's our end game here? What are we trying to get to? If they're dying from end-stage cardiomyopathy. Yes. Now, we may code them, we'll do whatever the family wants, but giving them a balloon pump is not going to help. Because if they're dying of end-stage cardiomyopathy and they do not qualify for any therapy beyond this, we're not helping them.
Right.
But it may not be comfort measures because the family wants everything done, and we're still going to code them and all that, if that's what they want. But they're never going to have them, hopefully. Because, if they're really bad atherosclerosis, we're worried about showering right from the balloon, but we're also worried about the insertion site and clotting off the leg or walking through the leg. If they have terminal disease, if they have stage 4 cancer with less than 6 months to live, why are we going to do this to somebody? And the reason why I say relative is because you may see it happen, but we hope it doesn't. I mean, it should be taken into consideration. An abdominal aortic aneurysm, it depends on how big it is, where it is it operable, are we about to go to surgery tomorrow for it? I mean, it just depends on what's going on. But if they're dissecting, we're not going to do it because that's going to cause more harm. And then thrombocytopenia, it's a big catheter, it goes into an artery, they're at high risk for bleeding. If they don't have any platelets, then we might not, they have to have enough platelets that we know they're not going to bleed to death from putting it in. So here's a patient with a balloon pump. Is this patient intubated?
Yeah. I can't tell.
It is a yes, no question. So you've got a 50% chance of being correct.
Oh, yeah,
correct.
No.
How do you say this patient is intubated? Congratulations.
I don't know.
How do you know they're intubated? They're like, we had a 50-50 chance. We went for it. Remember this right here? See that white line? That's an ET-tube. It's not an NG tube because it ends right here. Why is it in there? Because here's my corona, and then 2 to 3 centimeters above the corona,
that,
is where we're supposed to be.
I don't see the thing she's.
We have a bunch of EKG leads that are placed everywhere.
You can't really.
We've got
see
this big
well
long catheter that, for
yeah.
just a minute, I thought it was going
to
be a PA catheter,
you
but it stops right here. So what is that? It's a line that comes in and stops right here. It's just a central line, because where is it sitting? Either in the superior vena cava or right inside the right atrium, and that's where central line sits. If it's inserted, it's an IJ central line of some kind. I don't know if it's triple lumen, dual lumen, I don't know. You can't tell that from X-ray, but it's a central line. How's their cardiac silhouette? Looks pretty good. I think I'd have to do my finger thing, but it looks like it's less than half. Do they have an effusion?
No.
Nope. See a sharp B? See a sharp B? Do they have infiltrates? Is it cloudy today? It's a little cloudy, so yes, they have some infiltrates. I'm not going to make you read a chest x-ray on the test, okay? Radiologists read chest x-rays. But you need to get comfortable looking at them. So that was not a test. We were just doing that for fun. Wasn't that fun? But what we see right here is this just rogue spot in the middle of their chest. The whole balloon pump is not radio-opaque like the ET tube and the central line and the PA catheter, but the tip of it is. And really, what we care about is where the tip is, because that tells us where the balloon is, to tell me if we're in the right place. So the doctors will look at this to see if we're getting too high. If just like with the PA catheter, if I see this and this tip is way up here, what am I going to look at?
Urine output.
What am I going to assess? I'm going to check radio pulses. I'm going to look at the temperature. And I'm going to look at the temperature. I'm going to check the temperature. I'm going to see if they're mottled. I'm going to check capillary refill. Because all of those things tell me perfusion. And I'm looking to see, do I have good perfusion in my left arm? Because I know that's blocked first. If they're already having neuro changes, we probably already lost an arm because we bypassed that and moved right on up to the carotid, and that's real bad. But that's what this is for. The other thing I'm going to look at is the depth at the insertion site, because you can see that on this too, and we'll see if it's changed. So even if my pulses are all good, if it's further in than it was, we may want to get the doctors to look at it to see if it's still in the correct place. We usually do them every morning. On patients with PA catheters and balloon pumps, they're usually getting a chest x-ray every morning. It has to be ordered by the physician, so it's not something you're just doing. But they usually do one every morning. So if you have a patient with a balloon pump, you're going to look at the site, you're going to look at the dressing for all the reasons that we look at those for everything that's sticking through skin, because it can get infected, it can bleed, you can get a hematoma, all those things can happen. You're going to check peripheral circulation, upper and lower, and y'all already know why. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because one of them tells me placement of balloon, and the other one tells me if we're blocking off because you have this big line in their artery. Anytime you have a line in an artery, you should be looking at distal circulation to that. It doesn't matter if it's an arterial line, an arterial sheath, or a balloon pump. Distal circulation should always be something you're checking. We're going to watch their urine output hourly. Because it tells us, first of all, the kidneys are persnickety. I used to teach, when I would teach in fourth level, I would tell my students, the heart and lungs are married, and the kidneys are the other woman. So if you affect the heart, you affect the lungs almost instantaneously, and vice versa. You go into heart failure, your lungs fill up with fluid. They are one. And then the kidneys, within 24, 48 hours, are going to be messed up too, because it trickles down here. The kidneys require a lot of cardiac output. If your cardiac output falls for some reason, they do not tolerate that. So, number one, it tells me if my blood pump's working well, if I'm making urine, I'm perfusing well, because the kidneys are going to let you know if they're unhappy. Number two, it tells me placements, because if my patient looks like they're perfusing everywhere, and my urine output's dropped off, it may be a placement issue. Once again, we're transducing pressure, so what do we have to have? We have to have a transducer, we have to have pressure set up. We're going to flush that balloon pump every hour. Our policy says 15 seconds every hour. We don't do that with others, but this one is life-saving. Keep in mind, an arterial line is giving us numbers, but it's not doing anything for the patient. It's giving us data. A balloon pump is saving a life. We don't want it to fall off, right? So we're not drawing blood through it, ever. Not even one chance I can think of, that's one of your ever. We're never, I can't think of a time that we draw blood through a balloon pump. Do not go in and put your blood card close to do a one touch in your balloon pump because you lost your A-line. They're going to kill you, okay? Don't do that. You're flushing your pressure set up. You're pulling your blood jiggy, or you're squeezing your weight things. It's a transducer just like it was on every other pressure set up. And it's flowing through the balloon pump into the aorta. Just like it flows, I know that sounds scary, but we're flushing into an aorta. You're flushing that pressure set up to keep it from clotting off, because if it clots off, we have to pull it out, and they need it. So you're flushing every hour. Our policy says for 15 seconds. Never draw blood through it, because we know it's high risk for clotting off, and there's no reason to do that. Stick a finger if you need to. Why are you confused? What's confusing? We're going to talk about that in just a minute. So we're transducing because the only way that the balloon pump knows when to inflate and deflate is because it's looking at your arterial long waveform. So you actually have an arterial long waveform that we're going to look at in a minute. And it's going to look different because you have a balloon that's doing crazy things to it. And it's watching EKG. And depending on, we can tell it to time off either one. We usually time off EKG is what we default to, but sometimes we can't get a good EKG reading, and sometimes the heart's so sick it gives you ugly EKGs, and it will time off that arterial line waveform instead. But you do, and it's actually reading an arterial line waveform from the balloon pump. It's not reading the art line from your arm. So, do you want it to fire on the arm? What's happening in the arm? So let's think about it. P is what? What's happening electrically? Atrial contraction, atrial depolarization. QRS is your ventricles depolarizing. And your T is the ventricles repolarized. Your atrium is repolarized too. You just really can't see it because the ventricles are so loud and noisy. Right. He's always want to be the center of attention. So, if you think about it, when do we want our balloon to inflate?
Right.
So, QRS happens, ventricles start to relax, valve closes, balloon inflates. So, it times off the QRS, but not on the QRS. So, it falls right after the QRS. And you'll see a picture in just a minute. Not really, we don't want it to wait that long, so it's not really way out there at the T, because you know all that stuff's happening really quickly. It's not really out there at the T, but it falls right behind the QRS.
Oh, okay.
So that's timing, and we do want to watch that, because if it's inflating at the wrong time, even if we have a competent valve, if it inflates too early, it's going to shove blood into the left ventricle. We don't want that. If it inflates too late, then we can mess up when it deflates, and we want it to deflate to help with that cardiac output. So timing is important. As well as position. And then there's modes on these balloon pumps. The balloon can be on 1-1, 1-2, 1-3. 1-1 is what we usually use, and the vendor will tell you it's the only method that you should use, because if you have a balloon pump in, you want it to be working. So 1-1 means every time you have QRS, it's going to fire right after that. One to two means it does every other beat. One to three means it does every third beat. What our doctors will do sometimes is if they're trying to wean the balloon pump to see how the patient will do without it, they'll turn them down to one to two or one to three to see how do they maintain their cardiac output when we quit helping them as much. We don't really go below that because if you have a balloon that's just kind of sitting in there hanging out, chilling in the aorta while blood is flowing past it, what are you going to make? Clot. So we don't like that. And the balloon is programmed to where if you pause it for a second, it doesn't really stop moving. As long as it's functioning like it's supposed to and it's not alarming, it will sit in there and go and kind of vibrate to where it's not really affecting anything, but it's kind of shaking all the platelets off to try to keep them from sticking. If the balloon malfunctions, it's going to start making lots of noises and it's not vibrating anymore, and we can't let it sit that way for very long because they'll make a clot. And if you walk in and it's an alarm, and we've got to like 5 minutes, we don't try to fix it anymore. We call the doctor to pull it because if it's been sitting there for 5 minutes and we turn it over, it'll shower clots everywhere. We've already talked about positioning of the catheter, but also think about positioning of the patient. You have a really big line that's going in a femoral groin site. We can't bend them at the hip at all. If they're awake and talking to you and life is good, which they're not always, but they can be, then we can tilt their bed as long as we keep it straight to let them eat, drink, that kind of thing. We can tilt the patient from left to right, but they cannot bend at the hip. So if they're not cooperative, confused on the bend, whatever, sometimes we have to do a neo-mobilizer, like for someone that's hurt their knee. There's nothing wrong with their knee, but we're trying to keep their leg straight. And if that doesn't keep their leg straight in bed, and they're picking it up off the bed, trying to keep nurses, whatever, because that happens sometimes too, then we'll actually restrain that leg because it is life-threatening. We need them to get their therapy, and the gases can't come and go to do that if it's kinked off, and we don't want to cause damage to the vessel. I didn't even tell y'all about what is coming and going, but it's helium is the gas that we're using, not oxygen. Because helium is so small, it's lighter, it moves faster. And we want the balloon to either be inflated or deflated. We don't want to spend a lot of time in between. So when the balloon starts to inflate, it inflates quickly. And helium is such a smaller molecule, it moves faster through that tubing. So it inflates and deflates helium. And if you look at a balloon pump, there's a green tank that's stored underneath it. That's our helium tank that it's keeping. I think it's 5 minutes, but don't lie. It doesn't really matter. But every once in a while, you'll hear the machine at the bedside go, shh, and it's just cleaning, and then it starts again in place. So it uses the same helium over and over and over, but then it'll purge, and then we'll start again. So eventually, we do have to put a new tank on there, but it's not using that much helium every time. It just does that every so often. But we do have helium on there. This is a patient that has an Impella. Impellas, y'all know what a jet ski is? Y'all know if you're riding on a jet ski sucks water out of the lake in the front and shoots it out the back, and that's how you move forward, right? That's now all I know about that. But that same mechanics is what's used with an Impella. It's called laminar flow, and what that means is instead of it being like with the balloon pump, we maintain pulsatile flow, right? It inflated, it deflated, and it syncs with the heart. With an Impella, we can have a right or a left side Impella. So this is the left side of our heart, and this is the right side of our heart. And that's important to know, because with a balloon pump, what side are we helping? We're helping the left side. Right side, you're on the other. Hope you can be okay. And there have been lots of studies out there, some hallmark studies about how many people we lose to heart failure, because it truly was a right-sided heart failure, and we never intervened to help the right side. We've been so focused on the left side that we don't help the right side, and the left side can't function if it's not primed by the right side. So with an Impella, we actually can do either side. So this is the left ventricle, and this is the right ventricle. So for this left side, they're both in there together. We call this a bipella, which just means we're doing a left and a right at the same time. But for the left side, they stick it in just like a balloon pump, usually a femoral, but they don't have to. We have done one. We've done a cut down the chest. I have seen this one inserted some other ways. But they put it in, usually femoral. They thread it up through the aorta. You see it's going through the aortic arch just like the balloon pump did. It goes down into the left ventricle. And it's got this little curlicue thing on it. This little curlicue is just so it's not pokey and it hangs out down there in the left ventricle. It pulls blood out right here. The intake's right here. It pulls blood here. And the pump is here. So it's just like a jet ski motor. It's sucking blood up here It's going through the motor and it's shooting it out here continuously. It doesn't care what's going on in the heart. It doesn't care what rhythm you're in. It doesn't care what your heart rate is. It flows continuously with a pulsatile flow. So what? You can hear it humming when you listen to them, yes. And so it pulls blood continuously. So we have several different kinds of impellas, and the kind of impella tells you how much the flow is. So if we put in a 2.5, if you had guess, how many liters a minute does it roughly pump? Very smart people you are. If we put in a 5.0 on the other end, then it can pump almost 5 liters. It doesn't actually do 5 liters because we're not robots, but it does close to 5 liters of flow. And how much, what's normal cardiac output? Am I going to pass that around? So we could maintain life with a pulsatile flow and your heart doing nothing with an impeller. So you may feel, and they don't even have pulses. You may look up and they're in V-fib, and it's just still purring away and pushing forward as much volume as it can, which with a 5.0, which does have to go through a cut down, it can't go through the leg because it's too big. It can be pushing forward almost 5 liters a minute of blood flow, and their heart's not moving. We've had a patient before, they've done an echo at the bedside, and I cannot read an echo. I know less about echoes than I do chest x-rays, but I know it's stuff supposed to be moving. And they'll put an echo on the chest, and there is no movement. But we've got 5 liters of forward flow. The organs are perfused. We're not in renal failure because we are mechanically pushing all of that forward. Yes. If they need a little bit of support, they can put in a smaller pump, they can go through the leg. If they're in the big bed, we got a problem, and they need 5 to 4 liters of support, they have to go in through a cut down on the chest, because the pump... Walk straight a minute. Well, these people aren't walking down the halls. They're very sick. They're laying in the bed. They're not having picnics. They're not picking out tomatoes at Walmart. Like, these people are sick, sick. This is not permanent either. This is a short-term device. And so we're not moving around a whole lot with these people. So that's number one. We're very careful. And they secure it where it comes out and it locks in at the insertion. It doesn't lock here. But we also are looking at waveforms because we have waveforms that are coming that we're getting feedback from this. And we watch those waveforms, which tell us placement. And y'all don't have to learn all that. I just want y'all to know that these exist. So in this patient, they have a left-sided that's threaded up through the aortic valve into the left ventricle. It's sucking blood out of the left ventricle into the aorta. This patient also has a right-sided impeller that comes up. These are very difficult to insert. Goes through the right atrium and then over here to the pulmonary artery. So it's sucking blood here from the right ventricle and shooting it out here into the pulmonary artery. So their heart could not be moving at all. They would have to have bipellate. They'd have to have both. They have to support both sides. But they can have both of these in. And we've actually had a patient that came in, had a huge MI, was young, had a horrible family history, but they had not had a history themselves, had a huge MI. We put bipellates in them, stabilized them over a couple of days, and then transferred them to Baylor for a heart transplant workup because they met criteria. But they would have died without the bipillars because their heart was doing hardly anything. And what do you think your arterial line looks like if their heart's doing hardly anything? It's very dampened or it's flat. All their flow is coming from this, and this does not produce pulse because it's laminar flow. So if you have an almost dead heart or a balloon pump help heart, no, which is why they've kind of gone out of vogue. Because this can help somebody that's a little bit sick or a whole lot sick or almost dead. A balloon pump, they have to have pulsatile flow, and they have to have enough cardiac output. We can help move that blood, but it can't replace their cardiac output. So this is an impeller. We're going to look at a picture of one in a minute. And then we also have ECMO. ECMO is extracorporeal membranous oxygenation. If y'all have heard of people that have gone for heart surgery, they've been put on the bypass machine. All the bypass machine is ECMO that they do in surgery. If they come out of the OR on that machine, it's now ECMO. As a matter of fact, our first ECMO patient that we ever took care of, and I can tell y'all names because they put it all over Facebook and he's all in the news, but the Halton football coach was on the sidelines, had a huge MI, dropped dead on the sidelines, did CPR, got him back, came to our hospital And we wound up putting my back mode. And I remember I had fourth level clinical students, and I came walking in, I was looking, and my students in there, totally oblivious to what's going on, checking their blood sugar. Like, that's all, in their mind, they went and checked their blood sugar, that's what they were there for, they weren't thinking about anything else. And when they came out, I said, how are they? And she said, their sugar is 128. I said, that's great. What is all that? She said, oh, I don't know, they told me not to touch that. I said, well, we need to know what that is. And so I went in, and he was on ECMO. We did not have an ECMO program at the time. We didn't have anybody trained to run ECMO, so we actually had a perfusionist in there that continued to run the ECMO in the room, and they were just using the machine from the OR in CCU2. I'll never forget. And we saved him. He got stable, and then we transferred him somewhere to be decannulated and all that, because at that time, we didn't even have an ECMO program. And he was fine after that. He would have died if we had not cannulated ECMO. And so at that point, Will Stein said, you know what? We probably need to have an ECMO program now that we've done it. So now we actually have an ECMO program. It's a much smaller setup, and I'm going to show you what that is. But there's two types of ECMO. There's VA ECMO and VB ECMO. We're going to talk about VA first. VA is what the bypass machine in surgery. If somebody has a problem with their heart and lungs. So it does the work of the heart and lungs. It may be that they've had a big CV surgery and they can't get them off pump. It may be a status post-COVID. They actually have something called ECPR, that if we're doing CPR on somebody, we don't think we're going to get them back. They can cannulate ECMO while we're doing CPR. We've done that. And we take over the work of the heart and lungs. We quit doing CPR because now we're doing all of that work for them. We had a girl that came in status post delivery of a baby, was very young. And I don't really even know that we ever figured out exactly what happened to her, but she was coding. We came into another facility, cannulated ECMO in the ER. You want to talk about big eyes? Bring your ECMO team into Spring Hills Emergency Room and cannulate some ECMO. But we cannulated ECMO in a very, it wasn't actually Spring Hill, but in a small hospital emergency department, our team did, and then brought her back to our facility. But she wouldn't have made it if we hadn't cannulated there. We didn't have that much time. We couldn't bring her to North and then cannulate because it would have been an hour of COVID at that point, and then you don't have any function left. And she survived, and her baby is good. And we've gotten pictures of her since. It's pretty amazing. But they call that ECPR because we never got a pulse back. We cannulated and took over for the work of the heart. Patient may not be pulsatile. Their heart may not be doing enough to have a pulse. Their A-lines may all be flat. Their CVP may be flat. If they have a PA catheter in, it may be flat. Everything may be flat. They are very unstable patients. These people are not in Walmart being as famous either. They're in ICU, and all ECMO patients are going to be in ICU. But they are very unstable. They're not moving around. Some of them we can't even turn at all. We worry about skin breakdown a lot because they're very unstable. We can do it to give them time to recover. Like my lady who delivered the baby, and then this happened. She was young. We kept her on ECMO for a while. Her heart recovered. It usually declares itself pretty quickly. We weaned her off her ECMO, and then she continued with her rehab and recovering from her event. Or it may be that we say, you know what, we're not ever going to get heart function back, in which case then they need to evaluate, are they a candidate for another more long-term device like an LVAD? If they can go for an LVAD, that's great. We'll transfer them out for an LVAD. We actually are starting an LVAD program this year, so we won't be transferring out anymore. But we'll transfer them out or keep them at our facility. I think our LVAD program stands up in a couple of months. And we'll do that, but if they're not a candidate for LVAD and they don't recover, that's when they start talking to family about withdrawal. And that's hard because you may have a patient looking at you, talking to you, following commands, but we're doing all the work because it's all flow from the ECMO, and ECMO is temporary. So we may be calling family in, they may be sitting at the bedside, the patient is included in that decision, and we'll sign withdrawal paperwork, and we'll pull ECMO out, and we know when we do that, they're dead, because they don't have any intrinsic function of their heart. If they're a candidate, but if they're not a candidate, if they can't get an LVAD, they can't get a transplant, and ECMO's doing all the work, then we're to the point that withdrawal is our only option. And that can be hard. When they're not awake and talking to you, it's hard. When they're awake and talking and know as soon as you pull that out, they're dead, that's very hard for the staff to be a part of that.
How long would you keep
them on ECMO? Depends on if it's VA or VB. VA ECMO should be short-term, like 2 weeks is long for VA ECMO. We do it for 2 weeks, but that's a long treatment for VA ECMO. VB ECMO, maybe 4 months. VA ECMO patients are in the bed. They're not moving around too much. We're turning them as much as we can, very unstable. The V ECMO is for lungs only. We're not bypassing the heart. We're pulling out venous blood. We're oxygenating. We're putting it back in, and then we're letting the blood take its normal pathway through the heart. So the heart's doing okay. You just can't oxygenate for some reason. Like you have horrible ARDS. We've done it a lot for COVID-19. Pneumonia. Status with COVID, and they wipe out their lungs because they aspirated or whatever reason. But the heart recovers. And sometimes what happens is we have a patient on VA ECMO. The heart recovers, but the lungs are slower to recover, and we'll convert them over to VV and then continue ECMO. VV ECMO can be 3 months, 4 months. It can last a long time. It is a longer-term therapy, and we get these people up and walk them around. I'm going to try not to cry, but this is one of our VA ECMO patients going for a CT scan. They are in the bed. They are not moving. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people that I can see that are transporting this patient from ICU out to the CT scanner. This is our ECMO coordinator. He's actually the director of respiratory therapy now, but this is down in our old ICU and a patient that we were transporting. So it's very labor intensive. It's very, you know, the person, he's the ECMO person in this transport, and he's in charge. He's got the ECMO lines in his hand. He's got one hand on the ECMO machine and the other line on his ECMO line. He's access to the patient. He says when we roll, he says when we stop, he says how fast we go. My role during this transport, other than being the photographer who was taking pictures, was to go clear the hall. We don't want to be in the hall, we want everybody in the way, we want to be slow, steady, get where we're going, and not have to stop if we don't have to. But for safety, if we need to, we will, and he's the one that determines this because their life is in his hand. Yes, ma'am. It could be in several different places. With the VA ECMO, you have to have two accesses because you need a venous access and arterial access. So it may be what I see most often is like an IJ venous and a femoral arterial. So it's pulling from here, going through the machine, pumping, oxygenating, and coming back arterial, and it's actually flowing backwards. It's coming up to the aorta. What happens with that sometimes is they get what's called arterial steel, where their leg will get blue, because the blood's going the wrong direction, and so we'll put a little jump on it to go the other way so it's flowing in both ways. But there's lots of ways they can do it, but you have to have two accesses if it's AV. If it's VV, they can have two accesses, but they also can have one, and it's similar to dialysis, where it's a big line that has two ports and then pull from one return to the other, and so it's like going through dialysis, but we're oxygenating the blood.
Just for lungs.
Do you want to come up here so everybody else can hear you too? Because they're not going to hear you out there at the other campuses.
Or you can.
Okay, so what this ATENS is saying is that our, and I was going to say this at the end, our goal is not for you to be able to go out of here and run ECMO. That's not what we're trying to do, okay? Our goal is to expose you so that when you walk into an ECMO room, you can go, that's a big machine. What is that? And then you can start tracing it, and where it comes out and where it goes in may give you some clues on what's going on. And if you can figure that out, you're doing really well. And then you get a nurse who doesn't look like that they're running 100 miles an hour and say, talk to me about this, so that you at least know what ECMO is. But we go through very specialized training. Just because you're a critical care nurse, first of all, you are not critical care nurses, and when you graduate, you're not. But you are ready to start learning to be one if you want to. And just because you're a critical care nurse doesn't mean that you're going to be in there running ECMO. We have a lot of very specialized education you have to go through to be the nurse that's taking care of these patients. But I didn't want y'all to think balloon pumps was the only thing that was out there. That's the only thing on your syllabus, and to be perfectly honest, it's a very small percentage of what you're actually going to see in clinical now. And I don't want you to feel like what I taught you about is not relevant anymore. And I would have felt that way if all I told you about was balloon pumps. Okay? So this is the picture, and this is where I'll try not to cry. This is one of our BD ECMO patients. He was a COVID-19 patient. He's going to put this. I actually stole this from Facebook. He's been all over the news. We were so excited because he was a long-term BD ECMO patient from COVID-19. He recovered. This is day two of him walking with BD ECMO still running. He's not able to oxygenate on his own yet. We had turned down the flow a little bit, but we're still doing most of the work, and he's the one for it. It still takes a lot of staff because we have to have a chair there because they get tired. We're protecting our cannulas. There's nurses, there's PT, and there's respiratory therapy all walking through. I don't know if y'all can hear the sound, but I think that they have all flight plans. I don't remember. The family was there, dropped in with a very, very tough time the last year. COVID-19 has been hard. And to have somebody that made it was very exciting for them. He was such a kind family, man, and his family was so
kind. Hi, my name is Michael Zenn. I'm going to be instructing you on 10 signature techniques. There's a skin clean technique for skin closure.
Stop.
That's going to be good.
We don't want to learn about that. Unfortunately, he did get better. He got decannulated. He was amazingly well. He went to rehab, and I'm not telling y'all anything. His family didn't put on Facebook, and it's been on the news because he's been all over the place. His name is Terry, if y'all haven't heard about him. He was told, I don't know what you think about COVID, but I'm gonna tell you this, and it's very hard because my family doesn't all agree with me either. But this man came in. He had a little bit of a health history, but it wasn't awful. Came in, had COVID, was sicker than snot, was on ECMO for I forget how many days. We finally got him off, and when he came off of ECMO, the doctor sat him down and told him and his family, and they put this out there, that his lungs were never going to recover. He probably needed a lung transplant. But he was able to get off of ECMO on some supplemental oxygen. We started working with him. We sent him to rehab, and then he declined again, came back over, wound up back on the vent, and then his family chose to let him go because we had done everything we could, and there was no way we were going to save his life. So at that point, they're not choosing what the outcome's going to be. They're choosing what the path is we're going to take to get there. But that's still very hard for the staff. And, oh my gosh, I'm going to try not to cry. So if you walk into CCU, there's a plaque that hangs right outside what used to be my office that is all of the nurses that have advanced certifications, which is kind of what Ms. Athens was talking about a while ago. And one of the things that we recognize is if we have a staff member that gets a CCRN, which is your critical care certification, it's a national certification. And to recognize them, because we want them to do that, they get a little plaque with their name on it that has their name and their new credentials, and it's hung on that plaque because they are one of our leaders. And his room was right outside that plaque, and he asked about it and even had him take it off the wall and bring to him so that he could see it at one point. And so one of our nurses hand wrote his name on our plaque, and it says Terry in his last name, and he was an ECMO Ranger. That's what he claimed is his advanced certification. And if you walk into CCU, you'll see that we've had a professional one made now. He'll forever be on our plaque, but the handwritten one stays. COVID-19 sucks.
It does.
That story.
It does.
So here is a patient, just so that we can look at some of this technology, because we talked about what it does, but so you can recognize it when you walk into the room, and we can leave without me crying. This is one of our patients. It's one of our very first VA ECMO patients that we ran. I put a black circle to cover their face because I don't want to break your confidentiality. But you can see this is our Impella. This is the device that connects to the Impella, and these are the waveforms that I was telling you that we look at to make sure that our Impella is in the right place. You do not need to know how to recognize the Impella waveform. I just want you to know roughly what an Impella does and why we would use one and why you would be worried about it. But you can see this waveform. You see how it's mostly flat? This is not good. That patient is apulsatile, basically, and that's why this is flat. The Impella is still working. It's still pushing blood forward, but this is almost like an arterial line waveform. It's not really, so don't say it is, but it's almost like that. And if your patient's pulsatile, you will see the pulse of the patient in this waveform, and there is not one. The reason why the patient's still alive is because we have an Impella running and we have ECMO running. So this patient is on VA ECMO. If you look really closely, you can see this line coming out is really dark, and the one over here is really bright red, kind of. It should be brighter. This patient wasn't doing well. But they're pulling off deoxygenated blood. This is the oxygenator running it through it and putting it back in the patient. Except it's the heart and lungs, not what the kidneys do. But yes, similar to dialysis and blood out. It's funny you say that because this is also CRRT. So what we were doing on this patient is pulling blood out, running it through the ECMO, running it through CRRT to dialyze them, and then return to the patient. So their blood had about a mile and a half on it every time it came out and went back in. Because that's a lot of blood and a lot of tubing. And when we hook them up to the circuit, we pretty much have to give everybody 2 or 3 units of blood just to fill the circuit because it takes that much more blood volume to run all this. This is a patient up in our new CCU. You can tell we built a new unit. The rooms look different. Look how bright it is. It made my picture awful. Who is also on ECMO. You see, this is the ECMO machine. They have a ventilator here. And this is a balloon pump. So it looks like a laptop on a Roland console. And you'll see that they have, well, you can't see it, but there is, trust me, that there's a pressure bag over here that's hanging the fluids that go to this balloon pump. And on this screen, you would see a waveform that shows that arterial line of the balloon pump, but it's going to look very different than a patient who has a regular art line because that balloon's inflating. So you lose your diaphragmatic notch, and at the diaphragmatic notch, it jumps up and has another pump on it because that's the balloon inflating. And then you see the monitor over here that looks similar. Y'all do not need to know how to function in this room. I just am showing you what it looks like in case you don't ever see a patient. If y'all go to clinical and they have a balloon pump in somebody, and you're not, let your instructor know, and that way they can have post-conference there. Y'all can all see it. Don't feel like because you didn't take care of it, you don't get to see it. So now we're back here. You ready? So we said stroke volume is the amount of blood that goes out of the heart with every beat. 60 to 100 is normal. What's going to make it go up?
Increased.
Exercise. Very good. Anxiety. Fever. What kind of medications? Dopamine, Primacor, dobutamine, epinephrine. Those are all positive. Inotropes. And inotropes control squeeze. So if they control squeeze, they control stroke volume, right? What would make your stroke volume go down? Hypovolemia, you have to have something to pump forward to make it go forward, right? So if you blood out or you're dehydrated, it would make your stroke volume go down. If you had a big low line, if your electrolytes are out of whack, if we gave you beta blockers, all that makes your stroke volume go down. What about stroke volume index? Right, same. Because if I change your stroke volume, I change your stroke volume index. The only difference is how big your body is, right? Stroke volume variance tells me what? Why do I care? Why do I want a stroke volume variance?
Because
the change beat to beat is the definition. Why do I care? You're not in fluids. Okay? You are right. That's exactly what it is, and that's why I care. So, if my stroke volume variance is high, they're hypovolemic, give them some fluid. If your stroke volume variance is normal to low, they don't need fluid. They need something else to support them if the cardiac output's low. Cardiac output. What makes it high? All the same things you put on stroke volume. What makes it low? All the same things you put on stroke volume. The only other thing that I would add is keep in mind that if you give them a medicine that raises their afterload, so let's say you give a medicine that vasoconstricts but doesn't affect contractility, it can drop your cardiac output if they're so clamped down that their afterload is so high, regardless of the fact of whether you gave them something that affected their contractility. Does that make sense? Cardiac index? Same. Because it's your cardiac output related to your body surface area. CVP? Why do I care? It is about the right side of the heart, or what does it tell me about the right side of the heart? Why do I care? No, it's about the right side of the heart. It's about the right side. What's it tell me about the right side? How well we're priming, or is it failing? If I'm not priming well enough, my CVP is low. So low reason would be I've bled out, I need volume. It's a fluid indicator. High reasons would be I'm fully overloaded or the right side of my heart's failing. Because you may be normovolemic, but if the right side's not pushing it forward, your CVP is going to start to rise. Cardiac tamponade also makes your CVP elevate. We're going to talk about that in the CABG lecture. PA, systolic, and diastolic. Why do I care? First of all, if they have pulmonary hypertension, that's going to lead to right ventricular failure. And so that's why I care about PA pressures in those patients, because I care before the right ventricle fails, because I'm trying to keep that from happening. It also tells me, if they're low, that the right side may not push things forward as well as they need to. If they start raising, it could be either they have pulmonary hypertension, like primary pulmonary hypertension, secondary to nothing, or if the left side's failing, then those PA numbers are going to start going up. Wedge. Why do I care? What's the wedge looking at? PA's mostly looking at right side. What's wedge looking at?
Left side.
Left side. How's your family then? How's your mom? Right? Look way over there at the left side of the heart. What makes it rise? Left ventricular failure. rather than, wow, the left side of your heart is way too efficient. It's really not bad. It's usually a volume issue if it gets too low. SVR. Why do I care? Can I have blood pressure without SVR? I cannot. So there's part of my problem. I can't perfuse without SVR. I can't have big floppy pipes that don't have any tension in them. But if my top pipes are all clamped down, then that also is a problem. Because now I'm affecting my cardiac output, so now I'm not perfusing anyway. So there's a sweet spot in SVR. I've got to have some tension in my vessels to get blood to my toes and my kidneys and my gut and everything else. But if I have too much tension, then I'm not getting anything through anyway. So what makes it go up? Medications such as dopamine, levofed, epinephrine. What makes it go down? Vasodilators, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers. Watch your positive inotropes, because some of the positive inotropes not only make squeeze, but also cause vasodilation. So like if you hang primacor, when you hang it, you're going to see that the pressure goes down at first because it causes vasodilation. But as it increases contractility, it overcomes that and the pressure should come back up and stabilize. But it will make your sphincters tighten for just a little bit. PVR. Why do I care? It leads to right-sided heart failure. Think about the people with pulmonary hypertension. Their PVR is going to be too high. Right. So it causes the right ventricle to fail. Not because the right ventricle is not just fine, but you're working it too hard. If it's high because they have pulmonary hypertension, we probably give Viagra or one of the other drugs. I won't make you learn all those that we can use to help dilate on the pulmonary side without affecting the systemic side. And y'all keep in mind, with SV, pulmonary hypertension. Keep in mind, too, when we're talking about SVR, it's really common pathology that causes your SVR to fall is sepsis. You get septic, your pipes get all floppy, your blood pressure bottoms out. That's why we fluid resuscitate these patients. It's not because they've lost fluid, it's because their pipes are all big. So you have to fill up the pipe to get any blood pressure. So here's the good news. Is we've done all the hard part. This is going to go fast. We're going through the easiest part of this lecture. So you have to take a deep breath. And know we've made it. Okay? So most of these drugs should not be new to you. I'm going to tell you the parts that you need to know. My biggest thing to tell you is when you're at clinical, if they open the crash cart for any reason, not in the work code, because they're going to slap you, but after that's over, go dig in that crash cart and see where things are. In the middle of the code, when you need a med, it's not when you need to figure out where it's at, okay? You know, every facility has a set way that they set up their crash carts, and the way ours work is going to be a little different than the way orthopedics work. It's going to be a little different than the way physicians work. You know what? There is some stuff that's universal. Buy car comes in that gold box right there. No matter where you work or what vendor they use, they do it for safety. And so if there's a color associated with it, you do not have to memorize the colors. If there's a color associated with it, I put it on your slide, not because it's going to be on the test, but because I think it's helpful to you to start seeing what they look like so that when you need a bicarb, you need to look for that gold box. You still read your drug, you still look at your box, but it gets you to look at the right box because they're color-coded. So be nosy. Epinephrine, if there's a question on the test and the patient's in the code and you have no idea what to give and you're flat guessing, pick epi. Because epi is usually the first-line drug. It's not for all of them. There are some times that it's wrong, so I'm not promising you you'll get it right, but the odds are in your favor if you have no idea. We give an amp of epi. Have you ever seen an Apogex before? These Apogex are in this box. It comes in two pieces. Everything yellow comes off. They try to help you because you're stressed when people don't have the pulse. You pop this yellow cap off, you pop this yellow cap off, and you screw those two pieces together, and now you have a syringe. You pop this yellow cap off. This one actually has a needle on it. The reason why is because we have a patient that we crack a chest in CCU. The doctor can actually give intracardiac epi. Notice I said the doctor. You as a nurse do not inject things into organs, especially the heart, okay? So don't be rushing in there going, Miss McGurkey, that's not my name. Dr. Jones says, don't be doing that. That's not for us. But if a surgeon wants to do epi intracardiac, more power to them, and that's why it's set up that way. That is not for us. We screw We don't have to slow it down too much. Flush, or you have fluids that are up that are running, unless your patient's in heart failure or renal failure. You'll save yourself a lot of time and a lot of flushes if you're having some fluids and have them running, unless there's a reason not to, in which case we flush after everyone. And then we do CPR circulating, and we continue with that. It is the most potent alpha receptor activator. I will tell you, most of the stuff on the slide is fair game for test questions, except that you don't need to know what color the box is. Okay, I just did that to help you. And you don't have to know doses, because Ms. Downey said they don't make you learn doses here. It hurt my heart a little bit, because I think if I know you're good, we'll know you're an epi, but they write the test questions, not me, so you don't have to know that. But if you come to work for me, you're going to need to know to give one another epi, and we'll say it. So why do we use it? We use epi for anaphylaxis, but the purpose of this lecture is to talk about ACLS drugs. So we are using it for VTAC, VFib, any kind of pulseless arrest. Or you can use it for a bradyarrhythmia, but I'll tell you that that's not our first line drug. Our first line drug for a bradyarrhythmia is atropine. So see, that would be wrong. Don't ever use it for a rhythm that's too fast, because it's going to speed your heart up. But if they don't have a pulse, epi's your drug. That's your first line. Oh, so you see over here that I said IV or IO? If we can't get an IV on somebody, my ICU nurses don't do it, but we'll call ER up here and have a little drill. They whoop, and they whoop, or they're laying into their, the front of their tibia. Put that on. Is the IO key?
Whip it.
Square right there. But there, it's just like something's in your garage. Screw it down into the front of your tibia. That's where our ICU nurses do it the most. They also can do it right here in the front of the humerus. And I'll tell you, if you go to YouTube and put IO insertion, there is a doctor that lets his students do it on him so he can demonstrate. It makes me want to vomit, but you can see it if you want to see it. And he says it's not painful, and I think he's a liar. But you can watch a video of it. You can see a video of almost anything on YouTube, and I have shown that to classes in the past, but I'm not going to make you watch that today. But you dose IV and IO exactly the same. If you can give it IV, you can give it IO. You push bicarb through IO, you can save a life or lose a leg. If you push bicarb through IO, they're going to lose your leg. You can bet on it. It is for sure. But if they're going to die, then we will do it if we have to, and know we've given up a leg to try to save a life. Then we're sometimes the questions that we get into. If you can't get it, IV or IO, epi is actually one of the medicines that we can give down an EP to, but if you do that, you have to go up on the dose. It's like 2 to 2.5 times the dose. So if we can't get an IV, we can't get an IO, we cannot get access, the patient's dead, then we'll just pop the bag off, squirt it down the ET tube, put the bag back on and bag them, and yeah, that's gross. And it goes back and forth and back and forth, but they absorb some of it. I can tell you, I've never in my career been in a code that the only thing we ever did was give intratracheal meds and we got a patient back. But it is in the literature, and we can't do it as a last-ditch effort. But IO, we do all the time. Side effects? It can cause all these things. Y'all should know most of these things. Know that if you have epi running as a drip, and you go in to give an IV push medicine, I don't care if it's compatible or not, do not push through a pressor, because when you give them that bolus, they're going to projectile vomit, hit the wall, say they're going to pass out, their blood pressure's going to shoot through the roof, they get a horrible headache. None of that is good. We don't want that to happen. So it doesn't really matter if they're compatible or not. If I have to suddenly start an antibiotic that's going to run at a high rate or give an IV push, I don't want to push that through a vasoactive drip, if at all possible, if I have any other options. Amiodarone does not come in an Abajac, it comes in vials, and you have to pull up for a dose 3 vials. So you don't have to know the dose for the test, but I'm telling you, if you're in a code and you know amiodarone's next, go ahead and start pulling it up. It wipes the foam, you have to pull it up, and you got to pull up 2 vials worth. So all that takes in the midst of a code when 17 people are looking at you, except the patient who's dead, you don't want to be over there fumbling with a syringe trying to get your amiodarone pulled up. So we try to stay one step ahead of the physician. Amiodarone does prolong your QT interval. So if you're giving amiodarone just in general or people, not somebody that's pulseless, you're going to want to watch your heart rate and watch your QT interval. Ms. Walker hates amiodarone because it does have a side effect that causes some pulmonary fibrosis. And we've had some people who saved their life and then they died from the side effect of amiodarone because they developed like the horrible whited out chest X-ray, and once it happens, they don't usually turn that around, or if they do, it's a really slow process. And look, it's a negative inotropes. That might be important. We use this for any kind of fast rhythm or give their pulses. And it's not the first line drug that will come in as a second line because it's an antidysrhythmic. The nice thing about amiodarone is it will work on ventricular or atrial. It doesn't matter what part of the heart is doing something weird, and the other one can help get them back in sync. If you push amiodarone and they convert on the next round, somebody in the room needs to say, you want to start a drip? Because whatever we gave last before they convert, we probably need to start a drip of it. It worked. We don't want it to wear off and be right back where we started. And we do give this IV push, but we give it continuous infusion also. If it works, we hang it. And then they can convert them to PO if they need to. Here's your side effects. I will tell you too, it's not on there, but did it happen? Any other one can cause you to turn blue. I had a patient I got to ICU one time, they came into the ER, they tried to intubate him. I think he fought them all off successfully. His O2 sat was 99%. They thought he had something weird wrong with him, that the satellite carbon monoxide poison, they thought he had some weird pathology that was causing his O2 sat to reach falsely high. But in reality, what it was is his amiodarone had turned him blue. So he looked like he was a corpse, but in reality, he was breathing just fine. And his amiodarone changed his skin color. And in some books, if you look it up, it'll say skin color change. He looked like a dead man. We tried to change him off of his amiodarone onto something else. We couldn't keep him from running to VTAC. And we finally said, you know what? I'd rather be blue than be able to keep running in here and shocking me because that hurts. So we put him back on his amiodarone. He was a lovely shade of blue. And he went home that way. And I'm sure that they look at him funny, but he is picking out his tomatoes in Walmart. But keep in mind about this prolonged QT interval, because if the QT interval gets too long, I'm sure Ms. Akins told you that if you have that RMT phenomenon, you wind up in VTAC, and the amiodarone can lead to that. So we have to watch that QT interval. Lidocaine is this pretty little pink box. It is an anti-arrhythmic. It mostly works on the ventricles. So it is a ventricular anti-arrhythmic. We don't usually use it on atrial arrhythmias. We do give a little lidocaine to help prevent arrhythmias pre-intubation. We're going to talk about that more when we get to the vent lecture. But we use lidocaine for any kind of ventricular arrhythmia, not first line. First line's epi, but we will use antiarrhythmics. And once again, if we push it and they convert, we're going to hang a drip. Here's your side effects. This is a word I can't say. It makes your blood a nice Coca-Cola colored. Binds with your hemoglobin and makes it not be able to carry oxygen. So your O2 set may look just fine, but they are not oxygenating. They are hypoxic. And the first time you go to pull back an A-line and get Coca-Cola, it will make you wet your pants. Magnesium sulfate. What? Yeah, it does. Drug to treat post-pump vasoplegia. It turns their blood colors. It'll freak you out. It makes you forget how to speak English, evidently. Magnesium sulfate is actually not in the ACLS algorithm, but we do talk about it with ACLS. We frequently give it. This will be something I probably want to have a doctor there before I just decided to push it. But if you have a patient that's in torsades, we know that that's frequently caused by hypomagnesemia. And so we will push magnesium. Do not think, because it comes in an Atogep, that you need to shove it in quickly. This is one of the drugs that you need to slow down when you push it. I'm not saying that we necessarily push it over 15 minutes when they're pulseless, because that's a long time, but you don't shove it in like you do an epi, okay? Magnesium affects muscles. And so if you look at all of these, what it's pretty much done is make your muscles not be able to function like they're supposed to, be it your heart, be it your lungs, be it your central nervous system. This is why women that are in labor get massive doses of magnesium, because it stops labor because it makes the muscles relax, but it's not selective. It works on all of them. And so we give it to stop the torsades, but keep in mind all the other things that it can affect. Atropine, the purple little box, the first line drug for symptomatic bradycardia. And I don't care what kind. can tell you that if she went into that much detail, if you have a third degree heart valve, actually it's not going to work on it, but you didn't hurt her. So if you have a symptomatic bradycardia, I don't really even care what rhythm it is. You are never wrong because you have to think first. It may not work if it's third degree, but you didn't hurt anybody, okay? We give an IV push, you're not going to start a drip of this one. It just is what it is. We give atropine, then we figure out what's causing this, try to get it from happening again. It's going to speed everything up. It's also going to make your pupils blow out and dilate. So if you're in a code, and we give atropine, and we get the patient back, and then they roll into ICU, and their pupils are blown, what did y'all give them the code? They're asking, you know, we had a stroke here, did y'all push some atropine? Because the atropine is going to cause their pupils to blow out. We cannot determine if we have a pupillary response until the atropine wears off. They also give it in surgery sometimes because it dries you out. And so they'll come out with their pupils blown too. It'll scare you if you don't realize they gave it. It can, yeah, it can. But usually people are pushing atrophy on without people screening their vision at that time. But yes, with your no, they're not blind forever, but just like when you go to the eye doctor and they dilate your eyes to do an exam, it does affect your vision. Not the same drug. But it causes that same response. So yes, it would have checked your vision, but at that point, we're glad we're squeezing hands. We're really not worried about that they can read or not. But it will come back after people come back. I'm so sorry. I speak with you all day. I owe you a treat. I'll bring you a treat when I come back. Dopamine is not IV push. It's a continuous infusion. It comes in a bag that is, does not let light in, because if light comes in contact with it, it'll cause the drug to break down. It doesn't work like it's supposed to. So this is what the bag looks like. When you rip it open, it stinks really bad. But when we hang it up, some of the hospitals will require that you put a brown bag over it to continue to not let light come in contact with it. It is a positive inotrope, positive chronotrope vasoconstrictor. So vasoconstrictor will start there. What does it do? Cinches the vessels down. What hemodynamic value does it affect? That's not hemodynamic. Yes, it does. My second little sentence would tell you that I would say, no, we're not talking about blood pressure. What causes your blood pressure? Blood pressure is a symptom.
Cardiac
output. Very good. It raises your SVR, which you are absolutely right that it raises your blood pressure, and we do care about that, but we want to know why it's doing that. And the reason it's doing that is because it's raising your SVR, because it's sucking the vessels down. So what did it do to your afterload? It increased it. Because part of afterload is SVR. It's a positive chronotrope. What does that mean? It increases heart rate. Very good. So one of the number one side effects of dopamine is tachycardia. We can't really give dopamine to somebody that's already tachycardic because it's going to send their heart rate through the roof. Whereas some of the others that were vasoconstricted don't affect heart rate as much. And it's a positive inotrope, which means that it increases the squeeze. So I'm increasing contractility, I'm increasing afterload, I'm increasing SVR, all in that same umbrella, and I am increasing heart rate. Am I decreasing anything? I can't think of any. If it gets high enough, you're decreasing renal perfusion because you've sucked down so much it decreases renal perfusion. Yes, ma'am. Yes. So we use it for bradycardia. If we push atropine and it doesn't work, we can hang a dopamine drip behind it and titrate up to try to get keep them from being in a continuous bradycardia. Or status post cardiac arrest, I'll tell you, we'll code somebody, we'll push heavy two or three times, we get a pulse back, we check their blood pressure is 100 over 60. And we're like, okay, let's go to ICU. And I'm like, bring an ambulance, grab a dopamine. Because what's going to happen? Halfway to CCU in an elevator, that epi's going to wear off, we're going to lose all our blood pressure, we're going to go pulseless again. So we have to be very proactive about knowing we gave all these drugs to save a life. That's what we're supposed to do, but they are going to wear off, and that patient is just as sick right now, if not sicker, than they were before they coded. So if they've got hypotensive, loss of blood pressure, loss of pulse, and we push epi and get them back, well, we're going to go right down that same path again. So we need to be proactive about that. Side effects, another reason why you don't push through these lines, and they'll do all of this. Adenosine. I love adenosine. We didn't have to push it too terribly much. We did on Sunday. I was on the street call, and I happened to be walking down 2 North, and they were like, let's get some of Adenosine. I was like, I'm coming. I want to come watch. I love Adenosine. So Adenosine is like a chemical cardiovert. It slows everything down, a.k.a. almost stops it, but the half-life is like 12 seconds. It's very short. It will be the longest 12 seconds of your life. So when you push Adenosine, it is very specific. You have an IV that's as close to the heart as you can get. So if you have a hand portable and an AC portable, you're going to choose the AC. If all you have is a hand, then use what you got. But you want to get as close to the heart as you can. We would prefer an AC. You're going to put tubing in there with a three-way stopcock. You want to have a syringe of your Adenosine on one line and a syringe with your flush on the other line. You're going to flush the line first, make sure it's good. And then when we're ready, you're going to go push, not quite that fast because you'll burst the vessel, but as fast as you can, push your Adenosine, turn your stopcock, push your flush. The reason we use the three-way stopcock instead of changing them out is because we want to go as fast as we can. You do not push this drug slow. And this is why when you have me for clinical, and every time we give an IV push, you say over 3 to 5 minutes, and you didn't look it up, I will say that's not acceptable. Because you can't push magnesium over 3 to 5 minutes, and you can't push Adenosine over 3 to 5 minutes. So if you look them up and you know they live in that happy place, then that's fine. Put them all in that happy place. You've got to know how to give your medicines. If we push Adenosine over 3 to 5 minutes, we are doing a stress test, which is out of our scope of practice. If we give it in a rapid IV push, we are doing ACLS, which is in our scope of practice as long as we've been trained to do so. What will happen when you do this is this will be going right along, and then this will happen. You will be incontinent. And then they will start back up. So I had a little group of students over at LSU when I sent you clinical over there before it was Oscar's. And we went in, and the lady was in a rapid rate, and they really were trying to convert her. They were trying to slow her down to diagnose the rhythm because it was growing so fast they couldn't tell what the rhythm was, the cardiologist. So they wanted to give her a couple of those to slow her down so they could see it, knowing that she was going to go right back into this rapid rhythm. But they determined what their treatment plan was going to be. So they said, your student want to push this? I said, yes, they do. I think I was way more excited than they were. But we went in there, we got it all set up. I said, we're ready, okay? And so the physician at Willis Knighton, we do not push a dentist unless there is a physician or a nurse practitioner at the bedside. There has to be somebody that can intubate because you're supposed to give a drug that stops their heart, hopefully for a very short period of time. But it's a safety thing, so you need to have somebody at the bedside to rescue if you need that. You have to have them on a monitor, obviously, because you need to see what's going on. We flushed the IV. It was good. We had our drug pulled up. We had our drug on. We had our flush on. We're ready. My little nurse was standing there. She's ready to go. And they said, okay. And that lady was sitting there in that bed. And she was like, I don't really know what's going on. I don't know. I feel so, it's just jumping around my chest. It's just going on. Oh, my God. What happened? I mean, was, because they slow your heart down, you may not, the first time you push it, you give a dose of 6, then 12, and 12. When you push a dose, and you don't have to know, they don't make no doses. But when you give your first dose, what normally happens is you see their heart rate slow down to a normal rate and then kick right back up and you go too fast. They hardly ever convert with the first one. You hardly ever see a syphilis with the first one. But the second dose is not. And we did with the lady this weekend on 2 North. When they pushed the 12 milligram dose, they pushed the dose, went flatline for about 4 seconds. It's the longest 4 seconds of your life. And then she kicked back into another sign for them, converted beautifully. If they stay awake because they don't go asystole, because asystole is asleep, right? They're not talking to you when they're in asystole because they have no pulse. If they stay awake because they get more bradycardic but don't go all the way, they're going to complain of feeling awful. I'm about to die. There's a horrible weight on my chest. And they are right about all of those things because we are basically killing them for a very short period of time so it can kick back in, electrically restart, be in the right rhythm. And it feels awful if they're awake during it. So they will say ugly things to you, but you can save them. And it's really awesome. That's you. That was Nick. That was my student. What did I just do? I said, it's going to be okay. And inside I was like, oh God, that'll be okay. So here's your side effects. They feel awful, like on the verge of death. But it lasts 10 seconds, and it's over, and then we have a slower rhythm, and so our blood pressure comes up, our cardiac output comes up, because our heart's not meant to go that fast. Cardizem is a calcium channel blocker. Once again, you don't have a doctor to push this. It's not really an algorithm. rhythm, but we do use it, and we use this for patients who have very fast rhythms that we need to slow down, which is usually, and it's atrial, it's an atrial drug, not a ventricular drug. It's only on atrial. Paroxysmal SVT, atrial fib with RVR, it's going to get atrial arrhythmias, it's going too fast. We give an IV push, we slow them down, we start a drip, we maintain, they'll switch them over to PO later. Here's all your side effects. If it slows everything down, it's going to cause all these things. If they're blocking calcium, it can cause heart blocks. Sodium bicarb, not even on the ACLS algorithm, but we use it all the time. Sodium bicarb is a base. People get asked about it because they're not breathing and they have no heartbeat. Now, we are bagging them and we're pumping on the chest, but we are not as effective as they are when they're breathing on their own. So we know if we've given a couple of rounds of epi and we're doing CPR, obviously ask the doctor, do you want a bicarb? Because we know that acid is building up in their blood from lactic acidosis because they're in an anaerobic metabolism at this point. And if their heart is going to convert, we have to get them back towards a more normal pH. So it is very, very common that we give sodium bicarb. It comes in an Apidect as well. And we can't, they'll usually dose it. They're going to put the order in differently, but they'll tell you to give an amp. They very frequently order it that way, which is 50 milligrams. You want to know doses. If you give too much, get alkalotic. It also, just so that y'all know, they're not going to put this on the test, really, but if you overdose on tricyclic antidepressants, sodium bicarb is the antidote to that. My son, that not the one I showed you a picture of, but a different one, thought that it would be fun to play doctor with my daughter when she was 30, and he gave her a whole bottle of tricyclic antidepressants that the doctor had prescribed for him to help him sleep at night because he had horrible ADHD. And she came to me and said she wanted a nap. I praised Jesus that my daughter wanted to take a nap, not thinking how weird that was. And then he got in trouble for something else. I found out we had an empty pill bottle, could not arouse her. She was so sedated. Rushed her to the emergency department, and we spent the night in the PICU after she had her stomach pumped and all that. Spent the night in the PICU with a block of sodium bicarb sitting on her bedside table because it is the antidote for tricyclic antidepressant overdose. I did fine. I was calm, cool, collected. Until I wasn't nervous at the time. I was barefooted, calm, cool, and collected on my bed. And just absolutely fine. And so we got up to the PICU. Everything was taken care of. She's asleep. Family left. Nurse stepped out. Lights are dim. I hit the floor and sobbed like a small child. And my nurse came over, gave me a hug, and went and got me a Diet Coke because we still resist yet. And that's probably the only reason I survived. Because after all the adrenaline wore off, my epinephrine levels went down, and then I collapsed into an uncontrollable puddle on the floor. It was very scary. And I wasn't a nurse, so I didn't understand what was going on. I just knew that there was a lot of people. And when they take your daughter out of your hands at the door and run through double doors you can't go through, that is a very, very scary experience for a parent. Calcium chloride, my PCU nurses love them some calcium. Calcium is needed to squeeze muscles, especially cardiac muscles. And so if we have a patient that we're having issues with, they're going into arrhythmias, we keep raising blood pressure, they love to push them some calcium because it's like some for the ventricle. It gets the ventricle squeezing again, increases contractility, and buys you some time to find out what the cause is. It does not fix it. It's just like supporting them for the lifetime of the drug until we can figure out what's caused the cause. Are they having an MI or are other electrolytes coming back? Or the hypoxic, what's going on? So, codes are organized chaos. It's a lot of stuff going on all at one time. It's a lot of people in the room. Everybody's stressed out. We're going to see codes that happen this semester that are very well run, and you're going to see codes that you feel like, I still don't remember. I feel like that could have gone better. I highly encourage when the codes are happening, if there's room in the room, like in our CCO, we've got lots of space. Go sit in the corner and watch. Everything's going up. And watch that rhythm and think, what am I thinking of this? And see if that's what they're getting ready. See what's happening. If it's out on the floor, you're not going to be able to see all that because the rooms are small and it's hard to get in there. But if they've got cameras in the room, go to the nurse's station so you can watch and see what's going on. Put some gloves on. Because you know what? If it's a long road with gloves, you can do CPR. If you've never done CPR on a real person and all you've ever done is on a mannequin, it is very different. So I encourage y'all to get involved. And then debrief, ask questions. Talk to your instructor, talk to the nurses once everything's calmed down and learn from that. Does anybody have any questions from me?